Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here in this distinguished organization and with this distinguished audience. My topic today, I don't want to keep you very long here. I want to get right to the point of my topic today. I was asked to speak about the connection between anti-capitalism and anti-Americanism, and the two do seem closely connected, do they not? In 2003 and 2004, I had a sabbatical year. I lived with my family in Scotland. This was made possible by a generous grant I received from the Earhart Foundation. And since Ingrid Gregg, the president, is here, I would like to thank her publicly for that. One of the things we got to do was to watch BBC News. Now, in 2003 and 2004, these were the salad days of President George Bush, you may remember. And my family and I, even my wee children, made a joke that every single night, the BBC News began with the following words: "Good evening. America has blundered badly again." Night after night after night. So anti-Americanism and anti-capitalism seem closely connected, and I guess it's easy to see why that is. Because during its over 200-year existence, America has, perhaps more than any other country, been a capitalist country. Now, some may wish to qualify that in various ways, I suppose, particularly because the term capitalism does not poll very well. I note, by the way, that that in 2010, 59% of Americans agreed that free market capitalism was the best system, 59%. That was down from 80% in 2002. By comparison, in China in 2010, 67% of people polled. Just think about that. They have us beat by 8 points in China. And of course, it's true that America has not perfectly instantiated capitalism, but nowhere has, not even Hong Kong, even though Hong Kong has for some time now been closer, I guess, to a capitalist ideal than the United States has been. But putting the niceties aside, I think America is not only perceived to be the global standard bearer of capitalism, but it puts itself out as such. And indeed, I think it has been such. So capitalism and Americanism are closely linked, and thus anti-capitalism and anti-capitalism are also closely linked. Now, I think this link is captured in a passage from, I'll have to do it given my scholarly work, Adam Smith. So if you'll indulge me for a second. Adam Smith, the putative father of capitalism, had a profound influence on the American founding. Some two decades before he published The Wealth of Nations in 1776, 1776, of course, was an auspicious year. In addition to the publication of The Wealth of Nations, that was also the year in which David Hume died. That was a joke. I was kidding. It's a scholarly joke. Here's what Smith wrote two decades before that. I'll quote him. He said, "Little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence from the lowest barbarism, but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought about by the natural course of things. All governments which thwart this natural course, which force things into another channel, or which endeavor to arrest the progress of society at a particular point, are unnatural. And to support themselves, they are obliged to be oppressive and tyrannical." That simple yet profound political economy was built into the foundation of the United States. And it has done pretty well by her. In 1800, the total population in America was 5.3 million. Life expectancy at birth was 39. And the real gross domestic product per capita in the United States was $1,343 contemporary dollars. $1,343. In 2011, our population was 308 million, our life expectancy was 78, and our gross domestic product per capita was $48,800. So even while the population increased 58-fold, our life expectancy doubled and our gross domestic product per capita increased 36-fold. That growth is unprecedented, ladies and gentlemen, in the entire history of humankind. Considering that worldwide per capita real income for the previous 99.9% of human existence on this planet averaged consistently around $1 per day, that is truly an extraordinary break. The United States has created more wealth than any other nation has ever created, And Americans' labor has been more productive than that of any other group of human beings ever. That's not too shabby. But in 2012, there is yet another set of economic institutions that has also become quintessentially American, even if it at the same time is quintessentially un-American. That is the welfare state. In 1941, in his State of the Union address, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt inaugurated a new extension of the American notion of liberty, as assumed in the political economy of Adam Smith. Roosevelt articulated four fundamental freedoms in that speech that he believed the government was bound to protect. The first that he articulated was freedom of speech and expression. Nothing new there. That was already covered in the First Amendment to the Constitution. The second was freedom of worship. Again, nothing new there. That was also covered in the First Amendment to the Constitution. There were nine other amendments in the Bill of Rights. Those weren't mentioned in the speech. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt had two new freedoms. Let me quote him. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understanding which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world. That is no vision of a distant millennium, he assured us. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own lifetime and generation. End quote. Just a tad optimistic, perhaps, even by today's standards, but consider those claims in light of the conception of freedom at work, not only in the quote I gave you from Adam Smith, but also in the Declaration of Independence and in the American Constitution. No longer would the government's job be merely to secure an arena in which each person could pursue his happiness unmolested by others. That's what Smith called securing an exact administration of justice. Now it would be to provide him protection from want and from fear, which, it turns out, requires a rather more ambitious and aggressive government than what America's founders had envisioned. So Roosevelt's call to improve upon America's earlier conception of freedom, to, as it were, make progress on its liberalism, began the creation of a steadily growing welfare state that now joins America's capitalism as its two great economic traditions. Alas, however, those two are uneasy cousins. Indeed, I think the two are quite at odds. And their conflict is on display in two of the most important recent political developments in America. On the one hand, the Tea Party movement, and on the other hand, Occupy Wall Street movement. I live in New York, so I've seen it up front, and I've smelled it up front as well. Here's the problem with those two traditions. Whereas the former, capitalism, sustains and enables the latter, the welfare state, the latter, the welfare state, seeks to destroy the former. This, I believe, is because the welfare state is steadily corrupting a fundamental moral principle that enabled America's spectacular and unprecedented explosion of human prosperity. To be specific, the welfare state encourages people to ignore, to violate, even to pretend doesn't exist, the moral principle that it is wrong to live at other people's expense. That is a fundamental pillar of an enlightened life. Indeed, it is what distinguishes a barbaric social order from a civilized one. The fact that most human societies have historically disregarded it, that many still do, does not change the fact that it is morally wrong to live off the fruit of unwilling others' labor. Now, of course, as a general default principle, that has to be properly qualified. Children may live at their parents' expense, for example. Adults who have voluntarily entered into partnerships or other associations have legitimate claims to support. Sometimes people have to live at the expense of others' charity. Sure enough. But the core principle nonetheless holds. To see why, and we mentioned earlier today that sometimes it's worth returning to first principles, so let me be explicit. To see why, consider this question. Why are forced labor and slavery wrong? Take that as a real question. Why are they wrong? We agree they're wrong. Why are they wrong? Well, it's not because they're costly or because they're inefficient. They would be wrong even if they were inexpensive and efficient. No, they are wrong because other people's time, talents, and treasure do not belong to you. You do not own other people. Neither, therefore, do you own the fruits of their labor. They do. The dignity of every human being entails that they enjoy a sovereignty over their own persons. They are the absolute rulers, as it were, over themselves. That means that they may not be used for other people's purposes without their voluntary, willing consent. Respecting people's dignity means respecting this sovereignty. Other people have just as much right as you do to determine how to live their own lives, to dispose of the fruit of their own labor. And this principle of mutual respect is not only at work in America's founding documents, although it is, but it's also in a famous passage, if you'll forgive, in The Wealth of Nations. I'll give you another one. Do you remember this passage? You can probably recite it with me. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their own advantages. That's from Adam Smith. Now, some people read that and hear selfishness. That's not what I hear, and I don't think that's what Smith saw. What Smith saw in those dynamics of voluntary exchanges was not selfishness, but mutual respect. I understand that you have your life to lead, and rather than trying to trump your schedule of values with mine, I will respect and respond to your schedule. Thus, I do not second-guess you, I don't question you, I accept you. Now, I submit that that is a surprising and a surprisingly profound way to respect others, regardless of their station. So return to the welfare state for a second. My argument is that the welfare state has not only clouded this central moral principle, it has entirely inverted it, even institutionalized its perversion. It's created a legal apparatus that allows, even encourages, some to live at others' expense, and this apparatus has given rise to the feeling among increasingly many people that they have the right, that indeed they are entitled, perhaps as a matter of social justice, to live at others' expense. Now, of course, workers do have their own rights, don't they? If they believe they are insufficiently, I come from New Jersey, not originally, of course, I live there now, if it can be called living. One of the bright spots of New Jersey is our governor, Chris Christie, who somehow has remained alive and in office for 2 years. If you've seen his videos on YouTube, so he does lots of these town hall meetings. If you haven't seen any of these clips, there are lots of them on YouTube and elsewhere. I invite you to go look, but I'm about to give you a line that's essentially cribbed from him. If workers believe they are insufficiently appreciated, or that their labor, their efforts, their services are worth more than what their employers, or in the case of public sector union employees, what the taxpaying public is willing to offer, then they retain the absolute right to, you might say it with me, quit. You are free to ply your wares elsewhere. Get the most you can for yourself. Your right to work or not as you see fit is the fulfillment of the very principle that I've been discussing. Now, I submit that the secret of America's spectacular success, or at least one part of the secret of its success, is its internalization of that moral principle. I believe, incidentally, that Lord Acton got the explanation correct, that the engine driving this internalized moral principle was Judeo-Christian morality, specifically the idea that each of us will one day have to stand alone before God and account for his actions. This is a profound sense of individualism, and Acton, I think, was right to say that that idea is what motivated this, this notion, this moral principle I'm discussing. But the fact is that Americans at one time felt that in their bones. Part of what it meant to be an American was the understanding that you were free to become what your abilities and your industriousness would allow, and that your success or your failure was none of the government's business. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask with a heavy heart, is that still our understanding in America? With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call your attention as Exhibit A to a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. This article was entitled, "A Graduate Student with $88,000 in Student Loans Speaks Out About College Debt." I think this article is an example, a telling example of where our moral compass points today. The article tells the plaintive story of one Monica Johnson, who is a 35-year-old Hunter College graduate living in New York City. And she has, quote, racked up $88,000 in student loan debt between college and graduate school, unquote. After introducing us to Mrs. Johnson, the author of the Chronicle article gives us this. I'm going to read you a paragraph in full. You have to enjoy its richness. Young people like Ms. Johnson, who are starting adult life deeper in debt than students a decade ago, see themselves as part of a new generation of serfdom. Even as their debt grows, she and others say that student activism around the issue is weaker in the United States than in other countries due to a psychology of shame and guilt, unquote. In that one paragraph, the Chronicle article manages to capture an impressive amount of what I think is wrong with America today. So with your indulgence, please let me spell it out just a little bit. First of all, the paragraph starts out with young people like Ms. Johnson who are starting adult life. Excuse me, but Ms. Johnson is 35 years old. Must I really point out that she's no longer starting adult life at 35? I don't want to be too personal. When I was 35, I had a job and was supporting a family of five. And remember, I said that the average life expectancy at birth in America in 1800 was only 39, and they managed to create the greatest nation on earth. Suffice it to say that she's long since past the point at which she's fully adult, and I think it does no one, including her, any favors to continue pretending that she's somehow still just starting out. Second, we're told that people like Ms. Johnson, quote, see themselves as part of a new generation of serfdom, unquote. Well, how is that exactly? She has voluntarily undertaken debt in the service of her ends. That's a perfectly American thing to do, as my late father-in-law said. Debt is the American way. That's what people do, and you pay it off. Well, but the word serfdom has an uglier connotation, namely that the debt somehow was forced upon her. Perhaps like the growing American public debt is being forced on future generations. But that's not what took place here. She voluntarily undertook the debt in the service of her ends. No one told her that she would not have the debt. No one misinformed her. I assume no one told her it would be magically forgiven. But even if someone had told her that it would be magically forgiven, it should not have taken her so long, over a decade, nearly two decades of adulthood, to figure that out. Third, what is the solution to this problem that the Chronicle article suggests? I can't say it with a straight face. Why, student activism, of course. Of course. Not working harder, not saving her money, not increasing the marginal productivity of her labor, not going into a different line of work. No, no, that's for the little people, I suppose. Not someone like Ms. Johnson, who has a, quoting from the article, a Master of Fine Arts degree in Integrated Media Arts, unquote. So the idea that sitting around and blogging and protesting, demanding that somebody somewhere give her something, that is the path to prosperity is, I think, indicative of a profound confusion about the sources of wealth. And here, I think, economists, of which I'll consider myself one, we have a lot to answer for that we have so ill and miseducated our people that we don't understand that milk doesn't come from the grocery store, that money doesn't come from the bank. And this nearly 250 years after the publication of The Wealth of Nations. Fourth and finally, we're told that Ms. Johnson and others like her suffer because of America's psychology of shame and guilt. Sorry, wrong again. It is not a psychology of shame and guilt. It is rather the result of a moral conviction. And that moral conviction is the one I was discussing a moment ago, that it is wrong to live at others' unwilling expense. That principle may be weakening, perhaps by the day, but it, like America, is, I hope, not dead yet. And it is what explains Americans' unwillingness to feel sorry for people like her. Let me come to my conclusion. Part of what has generated much of the Occupy Wall Street anti-capitalism, as well as much of the anti-Americanism here and abroad, I think, is the existence of what is more properly called crony capitalism, or the conspiring of particular business interests to get special privileges and protections and bailouts from government. Now here again, for the last time, Adam Smith is instructive. For Adam Smith pointed out repeatedly in The Wealth of Nations that the real problem was the conspiring of business with government. Too often, business interests seek legal protections from competition. They seek government release from the consequences of their own business decisions. They seek to restrict access to markets. They seek special trading or production favors. They seek to foist the cost of their bad economic decisions onto others, like taxpayers. And of course, politicians who are ever worried about the next election are only too happy to accommodate. That is an abuse, not a use, of capitalism. Adam Smith would have been the first among the first to join the Occupy protesters in denouncing that brand of corrosive capitalism, and every American should do the same. Thus, if we wish to extend the blessings of free enterprise, of the free enterprise system, rather than curtail them, and I say that with some trepidation, because as I was mentioning to some people earlier today, I frequently ask my students, if you could solve only one social ill, either inequality or poverty, which would you choose? Well, what to me is a frightening proportion of them say inequality. We'd rather be equally poor than unequally rich. Now, that's not my view, but it is a view of quite a few, and I should point out, American students. So if we wish to extend the blessings of the free market, of the free enterprise system, rather than curtail them, our first job then is to make clear, loudly and repeatedly, that crony capitalism is not capitalism. If we are to defend Americanism as well, however, we will also need, I think, to distance ourselves from the corruption of our moral sensibilities that the welfare state has wrought. We need to remind Americans that we, are capable of taking care of ourselves. More than that, we need to make the case that as full moral agents, we are required to do so. It is the duty of a citizen, it is the duty of an adult in a free society. Second step is to say to the Ms. Johnsons of the world, time to grow up. Ladies and gentlemen, remember the quaint phrase, land of the free and home of the brave? Well, that bit of poetry actually captures part of an argument, because freedom and bravery are two sides of the same coin. Being free requires the courage to stand on one's own two feet. That is what has made America great. And the more we indulge exceptions to that principle, the more we risk losing the cultural and moral foundation that has enabled American capitalism to succeed unlike any other experiment in human history. I'm not suggesting that we harden our hearts, but I am suggesting that we stiffen our spines. The great and precious blessings of freedom and prosperity that we Americans have enjoyed, and that some but not enough of the rest of the world has experienced, deserve nothing less. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. We have a few minutes left for questions, and there is a microphone in the center of the room. This is not going to be very. A lot of questions, but we'll do our best. And I see the president has arrived at the microphone. Phil Hughes, a natural-born aristocrat, his late father was a member of the Chicago Cubs, played shortstop in the last Cubs team ever to appear in the World Series, the 1945 World Series. President Hughes.
And my question has nothing to do with baseball. In fact, I don't have a question. I have just an observation for Professor Otteson and for all of us. And it's an observation of profound regret that we had today, sadly, to content ourselves with a message, howsoever graciously delivered by Joe Morris, from our President Barack Obama. It was lovely of him to send a message and Joe gracious to deliver it, but It just dawned on me that it is so sad that he couldn't be with us here today, owing to the pressing schedule, obviously, that he has, because I can't think of a single American who could have benefited more from hearing Professor Otteson's lecture than he could.
Dan Oliver.
I rise in partial defense of Ms. Johnson. Having five children who went through a variety of higher education institutions, some of whom unfortunately incurred debt. Student debt is, as you undoubtedly understand and all the rest of people do, is partly a function of the cronyism between the government and the professoriate. And it is because of student loans that the professors' salaries have risen, meaning requiring, therefore, young people to borrow money to pay the inflated salaries. So while her choice of words may be wrong, she is a victim, I think, of the cronyism that exists between and has existed for many years between government and the professors.
Indeed. I not only concede that, I second it. So as a professor, I will say that I and my ilk have benefited in many ways, most of them corrupt, from the various incursions of the federal government into higher education. There's another way in which I think one might consider her to be a victim, in addition to the one you mentioned, and that is that no less an authority than the esteemed President of the United States has said publicly, and others have said publicly, that you are a moral failure if you don't go to college. That somehow if you, there's another question, Roger Rehm, who is the president of the Fund for American Studies, will attest to this. When I teach for them in the summer, one of the questions I ask my students, these are courses taught at Georgetown University, students who are interested in going into philanthropy. You can imagine the political spectrum of students that attracts who are interested in going into philanthropy. I ask them, these are undergraduate students, very energetic, bright and ambitious undergraduate students, and I say to them, how many of you imagine one day that you might become an entrepreneur? None. How many of you want to be the CEO of a company? None. How many of you want to engage in productive labor? Not really sure what that means. How many of you want to advise people on how to give their money away? All the hands go up. That's a worrisome fact for the future of our republic. And so Ms. Johnson, I don't know anything about her in particular beyond what's in the article, but she, I'm sure, like many other people, have been sold something of a bill of goods. You must go to college regardless of what it is you want to do in life. You're a moral failure if you don't. And regardless of the costs, you have to figure out a way to go ahead and pay for it anyway. So here she is, 35, and I didn't relate the rest of the article, but at the age of 35, she's thinking that maybe she should get another master's degree because that might be the one that'll get her the job that'll pay for the other. So, yes.
Yes, sir.
My name is Eric Bootsma. I'm National Civic Arts Society. I'm struck by the very end of your comments about the notion of equality. Aristotle says in his Politics that the depraved form of government, which we know as democracy, is focused solely on money. And also, I was also struck in thought about Alexis de Tocqueville's quote about equality, saying that there is a good and righteous form of equality that wishes to raise every man up, but yet there is a depraved one as well that would rather see equality in slavery than inequality. And I'm wondering if these two things are together, that if there's a sort of a we've become so democratic, so focused on money, that we're almost impossible for us to get out of that notion, that depraved sense of equality. Is it? Do we have hope?
I hope we have hope. I certainly hope we have hope. I have children, too, who I hope to be able to have an opportunity to succeed in life. But whether democracy focuses our attention exclusively or principally on money, I'm not sure whether that's just democracy that does that. But I will say that there is a kind of I accept the claim that there is a corrupt notion of equality, and I think the corrupt notion of equality is a material equality, an equality of outcomes. That's not required by any conception of justice that I think deserves the name of justice, including social justice, which will be a subject of our future Philadelphia Society meeting.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to call time after the next question. Just one more. To show you how I'm trying very hard to be a child of our current culture, as we were hearing about Monica Johnson, the blogger, I'm thinking surely her tag is Mojo. it also occurs to me that if Gordon Lloyd, from Pepperdine, a member of the Society, I think is here, became an item with the managing editor of National Review during the Buckley era, they'd be Lloyd Bridges. ladies and gentlemen, Linda Bridges.
Thank you, Joe. I've recently seen around Manhattan a handbill that I think encapsulates the anti-Adam Smith view of morality. And that is, it says, if you take food stamps, that doesn't mean you're broke. It just means you're smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And that's about it. Somebody else is supposed to pay for you, whether you're broke or not.
There is a certain, speaking of corrupt conceptions, there is a certain conception of economics that holds that it's rational to serve your self-interest given whatever set of rules exists. So if there is a set of rules, a program that allows a person to qualify for food stamps or something else without cheating, why not do it? You're irrational, perhaps, not to do it. To the extent to which we indulge, I think, that notion of rationality, I think we are quite in danger. What made this, one of the things that I think made this country what it is the idea, without having this be a conclusion of a deductive argument, a long, elaborate set of principles, was rather the idea that I'm not the sort of person who would want to do that. Period. You shouldn't be either. Now, we can talk about where that came from, what the cultural, moral, religious roots of that sort of view are, but if your society, if our society, isn't comprised principally of people who wouldn't take advantage of others, even if they had the opportunity to do so, because they're just not the sorts of people who would allow that to be true of them and their character, then I think we are in danger.
Professor Otteson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well done.
And now, while I end things, quietly give him an invisible hand. We reconvene next year in Indianapolis, I pray all of us together. 2 years, I hope, in Chicago. And at 2:00, under the chairmanship of Ramon Parayada, a panel on overseas matters with Richard Pipes, Kim Holmes, and Bob Riley. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you much. We stand adjourned.